This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Mecklenburg County has chosen the plan to redevelop Second Ward into Brooklyn Village. The Charlotte City budget passes with no property tax increase, but you may pay more for water and garbage collection. We get the details. Gun sales rise here in the aftermath of Orlando, but Charlotte Pride organizers say they're not worried about security for the August Pride Festival here. $800 million. That's the price tag for canceling the I-77 toll lane contract. The mayor of Cornelius gets a no-confidence vote from the Cornelius Board of Commissioners for meeting with state senators on the topic. And Bank of America announced more job cuts. Those and other stories, as time allows, on our weekly news roundup this hour. WFAE's Tom Bullock is here, along with Jenna Deary, reporter for Channel 9, Eyewitness News. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, is also with us, as is Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with Mecklenburg County and the plans for Second Ward and Brooklyn Village. They decided to choose BK Partners, who I think is out of Washington, for this project. It's a $683.3 million plan for what will become this new part of town called Brooklyn Village. The choice of BK Partners was unanimous. Why? Anybody know?
Well, they had narrowed it down to three choices, and one of the choices was a developer group called Peebles Incorporated, I believe. And commissioners had gotten several emails from other people who had worked with Peebles before, alleging that there were problems, financial issues, and just not making good deals on their end. And I believe, I'd have to go back and look at my numbers, but there was one in particular that was offering this huge pot of money. Meanwhile, you had two other developers who seemed to have more experience. And so commissioners were really debating over whether or not they go with the person who's offering more money, bigger flash and expense, over the people who have more experience. So they ended up going up with this one. The big debate has been around park space, because we're talking about that area over by Marshall Park. You have Romare Bearden and you have First Ward. And so there was a lot of discussion around that and affordable housing. And I think from everything that came out this week, that was the best option.
So this is a private developer's plan. Why is the county involved at all?
Well, because they have five lots in Uptown, and they own that lot there where the old CMS building is. Right. And so it's their land. And so they're involved with trying to make the decision on what goes there.
For people who are new to town or who never come downtown, downtown is divided up into four wards, which were the original four voting wards. And Second Ward goes from Trade Street to Stonewall and McDowell to Tryon, if that's a thing. I think I have that right. How much of this area is involved in that project?
Well, it's about 17 acres. Is it right?
Right.
17 acres, I believe. Yeah.
And it's going to be mixed use, apartments, retail, offices, and a 130-room hotel. Is that correct?
Right.
And
is it hotels. Two hotels?
Yeah, two hotels.
Yeah. And the developer, now, this is Peebles we're talking about, right?
No, BK.
BK Partners.
Is Peebles part of BK? Is they're part of BK, I think. Or I could be.
Well, there's a local.
It could be
there's
conflating.
A local component, too.
Yeah, there's a local group with a national group that makes up BK.
I think Peebles is part of that, right?
Yeah, and he's
well, that's
the
a whole
pretty,
other layer then.
Yeah,
what goes into this choice?
Yeah, and I saw some of those emails too. I'm not quite sure what to make of them.
Right.
They were
a bunch of links to articles from other projects all over the country with Peebles involved, where it was questionable.
And Peebles is a very big player in New York City. He's bills himself, or bills his firm, as the nation's largest African-American owned real estate development company. According to Forbes, he's worth like $700 million. He's been flirting with, you'll see stories in the New York Post about him flirting with a run for New York City mayor. He apparently was a big supporter of who's the New York City mayor's
De Blasio.
De Blasio, But now him and de Blasio have had a falling out of some sort, and he's making noises like he wants to challenge de Blasio.
Okay, well, let's talk about the development here. This is not New York City. let's talk about what this is going to look like. Have any of you seen the plans? Because there's been a lot of complaints about the fact that everything looks, all new development in Charlotte, particularly with regard to apartments, looks exactly the same. Is this going to look like everything else we've been building over the last 10
I mean, there are renderings of it that were released with the meeting this week. And I mean, from my point of view, it looks contemporary, kind of that uptown flashy feel.
Yeah, and they claim that it's going to be sort of divided into these sections, and each section will have an individual sort of feel to it, and it won't be like one giant, you know, master planned.
Yeah, the problem here, though, is simple, is when you're really talking about the aesthetics, I mean, it can sound like Epcot Center, in essence, with the little villages, and it may actually look good, but one of the biggest... One of the biggest complaints, though, is you are still talking about a historically African-American section of town that was largely raised during urban renewal in the 1960s, and you have a lot of people who would like to see some of that flair come back, and that is not present.
And what is it? Is it? I think it's maybe 100 affordable housing units. Is it something
like that?
It's a very small number.
Very small.
And so I think your point is absolutely correct. That is going to be all but impossible to achieve based on what they have done so far. Now, remember, they do have 6 months to a year of negotiation, and part of the reason, of course, that the county wants to keep its hand in this is so that they can have some influence over what's going to happen. But based on the renderings and the numbers that we've seen, yeah, it's going to be like a lot of these other developments and projects we've seen around uptown.
So I'm being told that I was incorrect when I said that the vote on county commission was unanimous.
It was 5-3.
Okay, I stand corrected. One of the concerns here, and you brought this up, Jenna, is what happens to Marshall Park, because we've been told that this city is underparked. Marshall Park is underused. There's no question about that, but it's still nice. It's a nice park. Does that go away as part of this redevelopment?
I believe it offers some. They will bulldoze that in order to redevelop that entire block. But
what about the ducks?
We'll
have an adopt a duck program.
Okay, very good.
I believe they did a lot for some green space.
But that
was the problem with how much.
It's 2 acres basically, and Marshall Park is 5 acres, and so that's a lot of the fight. And some of the back and forth was, I think it was Vilma Leek was saying. Was it Vilma Leek saying that she was okay with the 2 acres? And I think Pat Cotham was saying, why not try and make it better and have 5 acres? So we're going to have that conversation. But you're right. I mean, I've been here 20-something years. That's been a constant conversation. Why don't we have more parks? Why don't we have more green space? Oh, we're very committed to that because that's what excites people to move uptown. And yet it doesn't really seem to happen. I mean, we've had some Romeo Bearden. Even that was truncated from the original vision, and you have the one over in First Ward that just opened. Again, it's very small. We don't have kind of that Central Park type setting.
It's small and it's hot.
Yeah.
You don't have a lot of trees. Yeah. You know,
trees take time.
Yeah.
They do take time.
We don't have it.
And there are big trees in Marshall Park, which will probably go. All right. The city council approved a budget that includes no tax hikes and no increases in bus or train fares. But it does allow for the hiring of 63 new police officers, a new fire department ladder company near North Lake Mall, and additional staff to remove street litter. How did they accomplish all this with no tax hikes?
Because there is a tax hike. I mean, let's go straight up with the legal definition of property tax increase. There is no direct increase to the amount you officially pay for property tax. But what is a property tax? If you live somewhere and you pay a fee because you live there, it is effectively a tax.
You are so negative.
So what they did is, instead of just upping the property value, they added to the trash fee, the pickup fee for apartments and for residential, you know, housing.
It's going from $25 to $33.
Exactly. And that's...
Is that a month or a year?
It's a year.
Yeah.
That's nothing.
But we're about to have another conversation about the apartments and garbage fees beyond that, right?
Yeah, I think this is just kind of a temporary remedy.
Yeah.
Right. It's a temporary remedy to, you know, what they have said all along, which is a policy issue of who do we provide a city service to? Do we continue to do it for apartment complexes? And then this is just the beginning, as Eric said, because it's going to steamroll from here into this whole pay-as-you-throw policy that they've been throwing around for years. So
government,
get ready. Here we go.
But
into
next
pay-as-you-throw.
You know, the trick here, though, is if they do that, I mean, and to catch everybody up on what's happening, over the last 2 years, there's been this big fight over the fee that for trash pickup that everybody's paying. It was originally $45, and then they bumped it down, and now they're bringing it back up, and it was all part of the original, frankly, it goes back to the loss of the business privilege license tax and how the city was trying to plug a hole.
Which the legislature took away.
Right, that was $18 million a year.
But here's the trick with this. Notice that we're funding new positions for police officers and for a fire company based on something that the city itself says that it may do away with here shortly when it comes to the apartment fee, because apartments are still paying that fee, and they're talking about getting rid of trash pickup for apartments.
Well, but it would be an entire savings of just not even offering that service, period. So,
there are also water and sewer bills rising. We'll talk about that and more when we come back on our weekly news roundup here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I don't know if the Pledge Drive folks could hear that music, but it felt like a time warp. We're back in the 1930s, but this is the news roundup. It's current. Tom Bullock is with us from the from WFAE News, Jenna Deary from Eyewitness News on Channel 9, Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Let's go back to the Charlotte City budget approved. No tax hikes, but room to hire employees, etc. There will be an increase in the water and sewer bills. Do we know by how much?
Yeah, I think it's, what, $2? And I actually wrote this down just to make sure I didn't.
For the entire year, it's over $30 for the average user.
The average user now gets average fee of about $33. It's up $2.54.
Okay. Who does this burden fall on? Or would this be considered a burden?
For everybody. It's on the fixed
rates. It's an opportunity.
Right.
Yes, but if you're making $300,000 a year, it's not a burden at all. But if you're making minimum wage or less, it's a burden.
Yeah, because it's my understanding that what went up, it's a part of the fixed rate and not on usage.
Correct.
Yes. And so, therefore, it's across the board. And the reason was to offer money for waterline improvements or construction.
The basic conversation that we're having here every year is partly what Tom's saying, which is that they want to avoid the tax hikes, even though we've had two in the last few years. But the service fees keep going up as a way to avoid higher property tax increases. And then the second thing, the city really does have a legitimate argument that, you know, the more people we bring in, the more wear and tear it puts on infrastructure.
Absolutely.
You have to get the water out to the more distant homes. And so, I mean, this is very logical stuff. Nobody likes it, but fees are going to continue to go up because this is a rapidly growing area.
But which then brings you back to the other sort of side of the critique that you always hear, it, which is then why do we keep inviting all these people to come in if it just means higher taxes?
Well, yeah, I asked that question of several people with the county and also with the city years ago. Why is it that we want more people and more people come in and they increase the tax base and yet the taxes go up? And they say there's a lag time between when those taxes come in and the infrastructure needed to.
And that's true.
Well, and that's the problem with Charlotte is that, I mean, every member of council would tell you that we've grown so fast that we can't keep up. And so now it's getting to that point where, you know, you're going to see larger increments of probably fee and tax increases in order to try to keep up, because they keep saying that we can't keep up with our roads, our water system, our sewer problems. I just did a story a couple months ago about the backlog with storm water and drain problems and pipes and all of that. I mean, some people have been waiting on that list for over a decade.
As part of this deal, the city will raise the minimum wage for their employees to $15 an hour by 2019. Why the delay? Why not just do it?
Well, let's face it, there's a finite amount of money that comes into the city. So you cannot make that jump instantaneously without significant changes to revenue. So in order to make sure that we don't have the third or fourth tax property tax increase in
three and four years,
you need to phase it in. And this is one of the few things actually that the city can do. Jennifer Roberts, Charlotte's mayor, campaigned on we need a living wage in Charlotte. They don't have the ability to do that writ large, but they do have the ability to do it with their employees. So the fact that they're doing this is really basically living up to a campaign promise.
And the past few councils, we should also say, not just the mayor, the past few councils have made this a priority.
Okay. Police Chief Kerr Putney asked last year for 125 additional police officers and 80 support personnel. At some point in these discussions we've been having, it turned out that you can't even train 125 new officers in the year, but this budget allows for the hiring of over 60 officers. Is that enough?
Well, that's the amount that you can get through a recruiting class in 1 year, which is why they upped it to that amount. They figured, you know, if we're going to do this, let's go ahead and get one full class of recruits out on the street. So it's obviously not what was wanted. The ideal would be to have the 125, but it's better than 50.
Yep. Right. And, you know, I mean, Mike, public safety, again, much like the infrastructure, I know people don't want to hear this, but, I mean, this is just
this is
reality.
It's what government's supposed to do.
It's what government is supposed to do. And it's particularly going back to the infrastructure. Look, we're about to have a big conversation about transit that's going to involve, ta-da, taxes or fees or both. So we're nowhere near the end of the road, if I may use a horrible transit pun.
John emails regarding the fee for trash pickup. Certainly $33 a year is a bargain. Interestingly, we aggressively recycle, and our garbage bin is often nearly empty on a weekly basis, whereas our recycling bin is full to overflowing. We also compost, and through these methods, dramatically reduce the amount of waste we generate. Now, let's move on to the county commission, because the newspaper's reporting this morning that the county commission has they're in line for a 16% compensation increase. I can't remember the last time my compensation went up that much, but that's another story.
Don't be modest, Mike.
All right. Salary and allowances will total $42,593 a year for part-time jobs paying more than teacher salaries, beginner teacher salaries, and they're going to get a $4,000 auto allowance. Yeah, wow. Is that for gasoline, or is that to buy a car or lease a car? Seriously.
I think it's probably
because you can get
for
a
gas.
Really nice car for $4,000 a year.
Yeah, I got a teenage daughter who's in the market for a car. I think
she might run for county commissioner at large.
is this
out of line, or is this just a new, is this how you float things out there and you whittle away at them?
Well, I don't know if it's out of line or not, but I know the optics look really bad.
Really bad. Yeah.
They've been talking about this since last year. That was when they began the discussion around raising their salary, which the $42,000 is an entire stockpile of salary and expenses. They started talking about the whole salary portion because they felt, well, we're running this big county. In comparison to other places like Charlotte, let's look at what those commissioners and those leaders are doing. But Kenny Smith on Facebook last night had made an interesting point that county commission doesn't meet as often as council, yet they're making more money than council, and they don't, you know, so then it's going to start to go there.
I'm sure Kenny was trying to help when he made
it. Let me call
it a boondoggle.
Let me rattle the page of the newspaper that I'm reading from. My cell phone. Democrat Pat Cotham, this is what the paper says, who voted for the expense change, compensation, said it was a difficult decision. She would have voted against increasing her pay, but County Manager Dina DiIorio told commissioners that voting against the proposal would not change the budget. She said, if you don't change this, we won't change the budget. The money is still allotted.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good enough rationale. I mean, there are other things you can spend it on
right.
other than this. Given that you have just had CMS come to you asking for $21 million more dollars, I think it was, or 23.
23.
Yeah. And you gave them, a stern talking to about the
values.
Living in your means and all that, and gave them half or less than half of that. And now you're going to turn around and do this.
I will say your colleagues did a very deft job of pointing out the contradictions.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't hard.
No, it wasn't. But still, when you see those numbers that Mike just read out, right next to what the county commissioners are going to get, it's a very difficult argument to make publicly to say this makes sense.
Well, and not to mention, there maybe the salary portion doesn't go up, but you get all these expenses. And it's my understanding that how this change will go into effect is with council, they get an allotment for
technology,
all of that. With the county, the way things work, what one commissioner had told me was they have to turn in receipts and then they're reimbursed for whatever they spend. Mm. Now they get a lump sum. So it's basically
a salary.
You know what I mean? But they're arguing that it's expenses and not salary.
I don't have the figure in front of me. The technology figure was pretty high, I thought, because you could buy a MacBook Pro – And still come out ahead. So what are they including paper for your printer in that technology?
Oh, probably expense? Apps, Mike. I think it's apps.
No. Okay. All right. I-77. We now have a price tag on canceling the I-77 toll lane project, $800 million. That's according to the head of the NCDOT, Nick Tennyson. We've been hearing that the cost of cancellation could be between $30 and $800 million. This is the high end. Is this the final number?
Well, I remember now, Jeff Tart told me last week, State Senator Jeff Tart said $15 to $68 million. Okay. So everybody's got a number. And the truth is nobody knows because it will
The magic eight ball.
Well, it will either have to be negotiated or it will go to court. So we don't know what the number
is. That's actually not either or. It will be both of those things before we have any idea what this is. And one of the things that I think is interesting to point out with Secretary Tennyson's statement is something that is not guaranteed, but yet he's still floating this number out, which is that includes about $500 million to, in theory, finish that toll road. Now, the NCDOT has not committed to finishing that road if, for whatever reason, the Sintra contract is canceled.
But isn't there also the argument that the state is making that the way the bill is written, that it would cancel the contract but not the project? Is that correct?
You would still have a toll road on 77. Whatever work is being done right now would halt because that's being done
by
Sintra. But from my understanding of what NCDOT has told me, that doesn't mean that the idea of a toll lane would go away. It would just then eventually be turned back over to the state and they would finish
it. Which is how they get that $500 million number, correct? Right.
Does the state have if the state wants to finish the project after canceling the contract, do they have to do it or could they simply farm it out to yet another public-private
partnership? But Sintra's the only one that came to the table, right? And that's why we're in this.
Yeah. Could they then renegotiate the deal with Sintra?
Well, Mike, the problem there is why would a private contractor be motivated to do it if they're not going to get the 50-year term and have the chance to recoup the money in the same way?
Yeah, I mean, that's
and you only have one bidder to begin with, right?
Right. So. And that's part of what the DOT has been saying is that if this deal goes belly up, it's going to poison the well for any subsequent private, public-private.
But remember, just real quick, Mike, there's an argument on the other side that why not go back to the state and have this funded through the traditional method where you're not building toll lanes, where you're building free lanes and you're paying for it with state allocated road money.
Right. And it is kind of telling that the state still hasn't, at least not to my knowledge, still hasn't said how much it would cost to do just one or two extra lanes between Huntersville and Davidson. They really skirt around that a lot because that is the most practical
congested part that needs the help the most.
Meanwhile, the Cornelius Town Board has given a no confidence vote to their mayor, Chuck Travis, who supports, I understand, the toll project and who met with Senate leaders on this. What's going on up there in Cornelius? What's this all about?
This has just gotten really ugly. And so,
and it's a continuation of what we saw actually last November with Jill Swain getting voted out in Huntersville as the Huntersville mayor and two sitting Huntersville town council members getting voted out as well. There's a real negative feeling when it comes to anything dealing with I-77 and tolls.
Well, and there's also this conspiracy theory making the rounds that Charles Jeter, who passed this bill in the House, that this was done in some way to give him political cover. And that the idea was the Senate would kill it. And now people who are in favor of the toll lanes are worried that somehow the deal making at the end of the session will lead to this thing being passed. Now, I've tried to call Charles Jeter. He hasn't called me back. But that is one.
It's an interesting question.
It is an interesting question because he was on the other side at one point, and he's, the fourth ranking leader in the House. I have no idea because he hasn't answered my calls, but I think it's safe to say that all the rumors and the conjecture show how heated this is. This is, if people want to say take politics out of it, you wouldn't have an issue if there weren't politics in this one.
Absolutely.
Is this no confidence vote more than a stinging rebuke or a slap on the wrist? Could there be other consequences?
It could be. I was at that meeting this week and I was talking to one commissioner, town commissioner afterwards, and I was told the next step would be to see if they could restrict the mayor of his powers. I mean, you're talking about a smaller town in comparison to others in Mecklenburg County, but that could be the next step. And, we asked the mayor too, so why not resign? Why not take this as a sign that they don't want to work with you.
Right.
His argument was, I was elected by the people to be here, and so I'm going to keep doing that, whether it's good or bad. And he believed what he did was good.
And he says that his meeting with state senators was to discuss his observation of Centrist track record during a trip to Texas. It was during that trip, he says, that he was convinced that the region needed to move forward with the project. But we've heard through media sources who also went to Texas that the Texas road is effectively bankrupt, right?
Oh, it's actually bankrupt.
It is bankrupt.
Yeah.
So why would he come back and say, well, we need to go ahead with this. This is a good deal.
That is a very interesting answer. And, Mike, the other thing that reminds me of when you read that comment is, remember, Secretary Nick Tennyson was sent on a little field trip by Governor McCrory to investigate the road outside Austin that has filed for bankruptcy protection. And he, at the time, Tennyson said he was going to come back and have a report. I've asked the DOT several times about it. I haven't heard a thing. So I don't know if we're ever going to hear
what happened. Even people within DOT don't know why he won't come out and say something.
Of course.
Even some of my sources have said they wish that he would.
Centra is located in that part of Texas.
They're U.S. subsidiary.
Perhaps
right.
Mayor Travis went to Centra and didn't really focus on the road.
Could be. Mm-hmm.
Or maybe the road doesn't go as far as Centra. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more. We'll talk about Charlotte post
Austin or, City Limits.
Post Orlando. Charlotte post Orlando and Donald Trump being in Greensboro, among other things. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the weekly news roundup, and we're here with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Jenna Deary from Channel 9, Eyewitness News, Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, and Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. The Observer reported this week that June and July are typically slow months for gun sales here in Charlotte, but in the aftermath of the shootings at that gay bar in Orlando early Sunday morning, gun sales, as usual after these tragedies, go up. What are people buying?
What are they buying?
Yeah.
That's a good
question.
Are they
buying handguns? Are they buying the machine gun or the automatic weapon?
The assault rifle is the word you're looking for.
I'm not sure of the specifics of what's being bought, but, I mean, it is an unfortunate kind of thing, psychological thing, that people who are partial to guns or gun ownership feel that any minute now, you know, the ATF is going to break down their door and take all their guns, and, you know, you get it demagoguing of the issue by like Donald Trump.
I heard the other day America has the fourth largest population in the world, and our population owns 50% of the guns owned in private ownership.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Which makes you wonder why the surge in sales occurs after these horrible events, because I understand the mentality, but I'm saying there's no history of this country curbing gun sales after any of these events, unfortunately.
And the other thing that, you know, people are legitimately worried in their minds that the government's going to come after them and after their guns. And it seems to me, unless you own a nuclear weapon, your defenses are pretty slim. You see, after all of these tragedies, what happens when the police comes in after the people are shooting the place up? Mm-hmm. They die.
Right.
I don't get it. Since this shooting and others were committed with assault weapons, why would people buy handguns? Why wouldn't they buy an assault weapon?
Historically, the trend is simple, and you identified it actually at the beginning of this segment. Historically, there is a belief that some form of gun limiting laws would be passed in the aftermath of a mass shooting. This is a particularly bad one, the worst in modern U.S. history. And it really sees a flurry all over the place of all kinds of weapons, assault weapons, shotguns, long guns, handguns. You see a disturbing trend, a realistic but disturbing trend, which is immediately in the aftermath of shootings, the stock prices of handgun and other firearm manufacturers goes up. It's a noticeable trend, and it is something that, you know, no matter what side of the argument you're on, it's just a statistical fact. And that's what it boils down to. It boils down to this kind of fear, because there's always calls for some kind of change after something horrific like this. You know, in Newtown, we initially saw Aurora, there were calls for banning certain kinds of, ammunition magazines, high-volume ammunition magazines. You've heard, you know, talking about bringing back the assault weapons sales ban. Right. You see a lot of people who this is what they fear. So they figure, let's rush and do it now just in case.
Interestingly enough, both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have said something about this, and they've called for more gun control legislation. This is Donald Trump representing the Republican Party, and he had a meeting yesterday with the NRA. Anybody know what the outcome of that meeting was?
They haven't talked really that publicly about it, but what was interesting to me is before that meeting, the NRA issued a statement saying that they also believe that weapons should be kept out of the hands of criminals and terrorists. And before anybody proclaims that that's some kind of major victory, the statement actually began with, we are excited to meet with Donald Trump, who we have endorsed, though we have not changed our stance on this issue. So really what you're seeing here, though, is it's a surprising move to see a Republican, de facto Republican presidential nominee, even broaching the subject in an election year.
Right.
Although, you know, I mean, he has said some things that are very, very difficult to process, such as if the people in the nightclub had been able to carry weapons, they would have been able to stop the attacker, which
is absurd.
I don't think anyone wants weapons in a place where people are drinking alcohol.
They had an off-duty police officer who was armed and exchanged gunfire with the guy.
Exactly.
That argument does not hold
up. But he was not armed with an assault weapon.
Well, no.
So there's the difference.
But there's also something here, too, just continuing on Donald Trump. I was at the rally in Greensboro this week, and I don't want to make it sound like Donald Trump is riding in as this giant champion of limiting assault weapon sales. He is not. He clearly pointed out during that campaign event that he is 100% for the Second Amendment and gun ownership. He even made continual points of pointing to Hillary Clinton and saying that she wants to take away your guns. She wants to do away with the Second Amendment. So, you know, just because we have this conversation going doesn't mean that something big has changed. But I do want to point out one thing that did surprise me, and that was an op-ed in the New York Times that just came out. And I want to just read a line from it. And, well, I'll read two lines from it because I think it's definitely worth it. The first line, from 2001 to 2010, 119,246 Americans were murdered with guns, 18 times all American combat deaths in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Wow.
Now, that stat is from someone who knows it well. That is from General Stanley McChrystal. General Stanley McChrystal is not a big champion of gun control until this point. General McChrystal is not a big fan of the Obama administration.
Yeah,
he was fired.
That's right. He was fired
because of being controversial.
Rolling Stone.
Yeah, exactly. Questioning President Obama's stance in Afghanistan. He is the former head of Special Operations Command. He is the former head of U.S. troops and NATO troops in Afghanistan. He ends with this. He sees this simply as a national crisis that continues to rage. He asks his fellow veterans, patriots who have worn the uniform, who took an oath to protect our Constitution and the Second Amendment, who served this great country, to add your voice to this growing call for change. America needs you. Now, I bring that up not because I'm taking a stance, but because I am surprised and amazed at this stance very publicly about this issue. That is something I haven't seen before.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think it will take that kind of people like General McChrystal. That's the only thing you can think of that would finally move the needle.
Because,
you know,
even
people
this
who can't be questioned on, you know, their, you know, allegiance to the country and, you know, belief in, you know, the Second Amendment. It's going to take people like that.
This shooting took place in a gay nightclub. The shooter's motives are still scrambled. We're not sure whether it was terrorism or something based on his religious beliefs or his own personal struggle with his sexual identity. We just don't know yet. Eric, you mentioned that in his condemnation of the shooting, Governor McCrory made no acknowledgement that the victims of this were gay. And in an editorial, you asked if the mass killings at that gay nightclub might finally give the GOP the gumption to embrace a more welcoming stance toward LGBT people. That did happen with a GOP lawmaker from Utah who came out and apologized. And we have heard, what have we heard from North Carolina lawmakers since this has happened?
Well, I don't think you've heard quite as much of that, or at least I haven't. I think I was talking with City Council member Luana Mayfield recently, and I was asking her that very question. Have you seen, you know, sort of an outreach from maybe even folks that you've been, you know, fighting with in the GOP in Raleigh? Have they been reaching out to you to say, you know, it's time for us to at least be able to talk civilly and have, you know, a civil discussion, even if we disagree on bathrooms and all that stuff. And she said, you know, no, that hadn't happened. She had, I think she mentioned one person, one representative who reached out, but she, you know, I didn't get the sense that it was all that, you know, positive or deep a conversation.
The Observer ran an editorial after Orlando asking if the shootings there would help us see our common humanity. And in that editorial, I don't know who wrote it, but it said, some gay rights advocates have wrongly declared that anti-gay Republican leaders have Orlando's blood on their hands because they created an antagonistic climate for gays. That, your paper said, is not fair.
Mm-mm. No, isn't that's not it? Fair.
No. As Orlando being my hometown, I don't.
Yeah,
I don't think that's
and
fair.
that's you know, overheated rhetoric, kind right. of in the passion of the moment. I don't think you can do that. That's almost, you know, almost the equivalent of, you know, like Donald Trump saying that President Obama is responsible right. and somehow involved with the Orlando shooting. There's something going on.
But when you pass bills like HB2, when you say things that are inflammatory, does that not give permission to people who are little bit on the edge of
well, no, health? You never have permission.
Yeah,
you
and
never
I,
have permission
I need
to do
I need
something.
To question that premise simply because. You know, you can say what you want about what is an HB2, and we've talked about it at length, obviously, on this program, but there's an ideology behind that, and that ideology is not necessarily one, it certainly is not one of mass murder. You may disagree, there may be different views on this issue, but it is not, I don't think there is any justifiable way that you can simply say that they directly caused this. They can, and those laws do, create some tensions between society, but that tension is normally taken... It normally takes place in, you know, public discourse.
I think you have a
you don't think it could be argued that bills like HB2 and other bills like that, people who took a stand against same-sex marriage, and mostly that was Republicans and conservatives, are not creating the impression that it's okay to discriminate because they are second-class citizens.
Well, now I will say that in that same conversation with City Council Member Mayfield, she did say she made that argument. And I think you can, you know, that's such a slippery slope, though,
right.
that whole line of reasoning, because clearly when you have the types of, you know, really polarizing debates like HB2 has been, it does cause some, you know, backlash, you know, but I don't think I think that may be more the exception than
because
the rule.
Because HB2 is not just about bathrooms.
No,
it's also about
the
environment.
Absolutely not.
It's not.
Mike, I think your second question or your second statement, that certainly is plausible and I think legitimate that you can create an environment that discrimination against a group is somehow considered okay. But I think making the leap to responsible for someone going out and committing mass murder is taking it –
Because you have to look at this shooter, and I mean his. Yeah. I don't think he was influenced at all by any politics or policy or anything.
No, and
this guy had clearly the information that we're getting out about him being on Facebook and Googling Pulse nightclub and shooting, and then texting his wife during the massacre. I mean, this guy had issues, and I don't think that it stems from any kind of policy or politics.
Right. Today marks the one-year anniversary of the shooting of 9 people at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston. Dylan Roof, 21 years old, maybe 22 now, white supremacist, has been charged with the crime. He requested a trial by judge and not by jury. That request was denied. Why would anybody want that?
Well, if you're Dylan Roof, you're maybe the one guy in jail who knows that a jury of 12 people are probably not your better chance of getting off because you're so universally hated, loathed by 100% of the population. You hope that a judge would basically on some sort of a legal, you know, sort of fine point would let you.
We have less than a minute left. The immediate impact of that shooting, those shootings in Charleston last year, was the removal of the Confederate flag. Aside from the symbolism of that, has anything changed about race relations in America? Has that incident simply faded into the others that we've had in the last 5 years?
Well, I think that's the distressing part. What Tom's saying is that they blur together. Obviously, in this part of the country, it hasn't. It resonates. Because we know someone who was involved. But, you know, in other parts of the country, you Aurora, Sandy Hook. I mean, it just goes on and on. It's just horrible. This week, included.
We didn't get a chance to talk about this, but we are featured. The city of Charlotte is featured in the Atlantic magazine this week, so perhaps next week we can talk about what they had to say about us in that article. I want to thank Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Jenna Deary from Channel 9 Eyewitness News, Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal for joining us. We'll do it again. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you.